Second Court of Appeals. And on my right is Justice Dalton Owen, my left is Justice Walker, and I'm Bill Meyer, the presiding judge this morning. I ask the clerk to call the case, please.
The court will now call Jeremy Bridges versus the state of Texas.
Counsel, Bowman.
Good morning. May it please the court?
Good morning.
Counsel. Factually, this case is distinguishable from others. In this case, we have an appellant, Mr. Wicker, coming before the trial court on a motion to adjudicate. That in and of itself, not unusual at all, nor was the trial court's question to appellant, do you have any mental health problems? His response to that was yes. It was what followed afterwards that's factually unique and distinguishable in this case. Afterwards, the trial court immediately asked appellant if he was prescribed any kind of medication to treat his mental health disorder, to which he said yes. Yes, in fact, he had been prescribed medication presumably from a licensed physician to help treat his mental health disorder. The trial court at that point in the proceedings then asked him, when was the last time you had this medication? Over nine months prior. It was at that point in time that the trial court attempted maybe to conduct an inquiry into appellant's competency, except that the inquiry consisted merely of asking appellant, do you understand what's going on here? To which he replied yes, and asking appellant's trial counsel, do you know why he hasn't received this medication and do you think he understands what's going on here? According to the record, appellant's trial counsel had no idea why he had not been given his medication despite his repeated requests for it, but told the trial court, I've had conversations with him and I believe that he understands what's going on here. At that point in time, that was apparently sufficient to the trial court, and she proceeded to accept appellant's plea of true to the state's motion to adjudicate, and then proceeded with the entire, found him guilty, and proceeded with the entire adjudication proceeding. The problem is, in this case, the evidence at the very inception of the hearing that appellant had been prescribed by a licensed physician medication to treat his mental health disorder and had not been given that medication for the immediate preceding 9 months up to his coming to court, that's problematic, and that raised a bona fide doubt that required the trial court to conduct an inquiry. Appellant's points of errors.
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am.
Why wasn't questioning the defendant and questioning defense counsel an inquiry?
Well, I think it was an attempt at an inquiry. I think it's a wholly insufficient inquiry, though, especially when you question the appellant or the defendant, and he's the subject of that inquiry. You're asking a perhaps incompetent or questionably incompetent person, do you understand what's going on here?
But the ability to communicate with the court and to understand the court's questions the standard for competence is so, the bar is so low.
Yes, ma'am, I'd agree with that. I think you have to have a factual and or rational understanding of the proceedings. And I think appellant's ability to factually communicate doesn't demonstrate any kind of rational understanding on his part at all.
Okay, so you think the trial judge should have asked more about the medication?
Yes, ma'am. I think, especially if you look at other decisional law, other appellate law regarding inquiries, this one was just wholly inadequate. The trial court moved from I think in this case, the trial court moved from asking those two questions immediately to accepting the plea. I think the trial court should have explored further appellant's understanding, rational and factual, of what he was actually doing. I think given the evidence that was presented up to that point, the best course of action at that point would have been to call a timeout in the proceedings to ensure that the constitutional protections were safeguarded and just had appellant evaluated. I don't think that would have caused any kind of unnecessary strain or delay on this trial court at all. Additionally, with regard to the question of his trial counsel, there's absolutely no evidence in the record at all that appellant's counsel had any kind of specialized knowledge at all in, with regard to any kind of mental health disorders. Right, Dr. Creason, Dr. Creason testified at the motion to adjudicate hearing in mitigation of punishment. He didn't testify as to whether appellant was competent or incompetent as it related to whether he could proceed with the motion to adjudicate hearing. He was called by appellant in mitigation of his punishment, and his testimony, in fact, indicated that appellant may have had factual understandings of what was going on, but did not have a rational or normal grasp of facts as they were laid out or proceedings or things like that. He talked about that several times and talked about how appellant, who had Asperger's, a form of autism, could be highly intelligent at times, but that intelligence doesn't necessarily mean somebody is also rational. And that was part of his testimony. But with regard to the inquiry, our assertion is that the trial court should have conducted a more thorough inquiry, given that there was a question at the outset of his competence.
But Dr. Creason had already evaluated appellant. You wanted the court to get another psychiatrist to evaluate?
He had evaluated him and found that he had Asperger's and an impulse control disorder, and he saw him a couple of times, but the record reflects that he wasn't then the primary treating physician. Regarding competency, yes, ma'am, I think given the evidence that was presented at trial, it would have been easy for the trial court at that point to either conduct a sufficient inquiry pursuant to Article 46 and the state and federal constitutional protections, or simply call a timeout and reset the case to have him evaluated.
But really, you keep saying evidence presented, but really the only evidence presented was that he had a mental condition and that he had been on medication, which really there's a lot of mental health conditions that require medication or that can be helped with medication that have nothing to do with
Oh, and that's definitely very true. And I think the problem, though, in this case is that we don't know anything more than that, is that we know that the question was, do you have any mental health problems? The answer was yes. Do you have medication, or should you be taking medication for it? Yes. Have you taken it? No. And that's all we know. And definitely, he could have had an evaluation and been found to be competent. I agree with that. But I think given up to that point, at the very least, the trial court should have asked more questions to make certain that he had the rational and factual understanding of everything that was going on. And those questions could have included questions related to specifically what the medication was for. We know it was for treating the mental health disorder, but other than that, we don't know anything about it. And we know it was denied him at the jail, but other than that, we didn't know anything more about the medication or lack of the medication at that point in time.
But trial counsel pretty well jerked the rug out from under you, didn't he? I mean, because the trial court did inquire of trial counsel, and trial counsel said, oh, no, there's no problem.
He did say that, basically. I think that's problematic, though, because you're asking trial counsel is he mentally competent? And the trial counsel can definitely answer that from the perspective, and he did, that trial counsel had been able to engage with him. But you've also got to look at the second factor, and that's, or do you have a rational as well as factual understanding of the proceedings against you? And according to the record, the trial counsel's representation to the court was that he had been able to converse with appellant and about the facts of the case. I don't think that in and of itself is sufficient, given that he's not a licensed psychologist. psychologist, psychiatrist, anything like that, that he was able to converse with him, I don't think necessarily absolves or dissipates any concern that there was still this competency issue lurking.
What about the presumption, though?
I think there is a presumption, but I think in the face of that very limited evidence at the beginning, that calls that into question. Without a doubt, I believe that it does. You've got an appellant who you know should be prescribed medication to treat a mental health disorder, and it seems like in this case the trial courts ask those two questions of the appellant, which my contention is that that's pretty worthless given that he's the subject of the competency question and then his counsel. And it seemed like after those two were initially answered, it was almost a full steam ahead into the rest of the adjudication hearing. And it would have been to safeguard any kind of constitutional issues, constitutional protections that he has, and statutory protections that he has, it would have been simple for the trial court to engage in the kind of inquiry that trial courts have in other cases, where then inquiries have been found to be sufficient, appellants have been found to be competent, and everything's okay. That didn't happen in this case, and that's the problem. That's our problem. It just full speed ahead and went on ahead without really and truly addressing the issue. Regarding the inquiry, other courts have asked substantially more questions. In this case, it was basically just the question to appellant and his lawyer, and then the trial court accepted the plea and the hearing went on. In Smallwood, in Lawrence, in Gray, in all the cases that we cited in our brief, there are substantially more questions to constitute a sufficient informal inquiry. In this case, it didn't happen at all. Regarding whether there was a bona fide doubt as to appellant's competence, evidence that there has been a recent mental illness, severe mental illness, mental retardation, things like that can factor in. They're not in and of themselves exclusive, though. That's not an exhaustive list. And in this case, we know at the very least there was a recent mental illness that had been diagnosed and that was at least attempting to be treated with medication, though appellant had not received any of the medication. Given those issues, our other contention is that following appellant's plea of true was necessarily constitutionally void given the questions that surrounded his competence at the beginning. This case is unlike others where there weren't those antecedent concerns at the beginning. Here we've got concerns from the very beginning and that also surrounds the plea. It kind of strains logic and common sense to suggest that even a questionably incompetent or competent person can make a constitutionally valid plea, meaning that it has to be knowing, voluntarily entered. In this case, I think there, given the evidence that was presented at the outset, there were serious questions about that. It's very clear that the United States Supreme Court has said in Pate and in Drope, this Texas statutory provision in Article 46 is very much like those other two. And what the Supreme Court has said is that the failure to follow that procedure violates a person's due process rights. And so that's why we're asserting that appellant's due process rights were asserted under the federal constitution as well as under the due course of law of the Texas Constitution. Regarding any kind of procedural default issue, appellant's case is distinguishable from the regular guilty plea situations because here there was error leading up to and including the entry of that plea.
When the trial judge asks, is there any reason the sentence cannot be pronounced at this time, do you know what one of the grounds for preventing the sentence from being pronounced is?
Whether somebody is mentally competent.
So,
and appellant's counsel and for trial counsel in this case.
So can you really weigh that at the stage of the trial when you're offering evidence?
I'd say it again, can you really...
Waive it at the stage of the trial where you're offering evidence if it's a ground to prevent imposition of sentence?
I don't think that it was waived in this case because of the errors initially. I think...
Can it be raised on the writ?
I think that it could, Judge. I do. With that, I will tender the remainder of my time back to the court for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrea Simmons, and I represent the state of Texas on this case. The state's standpoint basically is that the trial court in this case did conduct a sufficient and formal inquiry. And also I would state that the questions asked by the trial court regarding his competency to proceed consisted of more than one or two questions. I have it outlined in my brief, and it goes on for about a page and a half or two between the questions that he's asked, or the trial judge asked both appellant and his counsel. And he goes into some pretty good detail, although a majority of the appellant's questions were yes or no answers to the questions. And no, he was able to answer all of the questions in an appropriate fashion and deemed that he understood what was happening. And furthermore, his counsel continuously reiterated that he had no problems communicating with the appellant, that the appellant understood what was happening, that there had been no issues of mental illnesses during the time of his representation, and that he felt positive that they were able to continue and there were no issues of mental incompetency. There's a lot of case law, especially out of this court, that's really close to the facts of this case as far as handling an informal inquiry. There's an unpublished opinion out of this court, Hill v. State, 2007, Tex App, Lexus, 2272, where the appellant also claimed he was incompetent to stand trial and thus his plea was involuntary. In this case, the record reflects that as far as the involuntary plea, that he was properly admonished and thus it presented a prima facie showing that the plea was true, that the plea of true was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Also, the state would argue that there was no preservation of the issue of voluntariness of a plea at any time that would preserve the issue for appellate review.
I don't think that's my strongest point.
But the strongest point is ultimately that the inquiry in this case as to the appellant's mental competency was sufficient. And because his competency issue is his competency was properly determined, the plea was voluntary, and that the state proved its prima facie showing as to that. The main issue before this court is whether the trial court abused its discretion by not holding a competency evaluation after having conducted the informal inquiry in this case.
What about Dr. Creason's examination?
Creason's examination, they offered his testimony, if anything, once he did testify, did nothing but build the state's case and prove his competency. He went into detail about Asperger's syndrome, saying that it was basically a social issue, that people have with Asperger's have an issue with their social skills. However, they're bright, they're intelligent, they're understanding. He even said from a legalistic standard, he knows what's happening. He has social skill problems on as far as his interaction with others, on what behaviors may be appropriate or inappropriate. But he understands that there's going to be consequences for his behaviors, what those consequences are, and he understood exactly what he was in court for on this day. Also, Dr. Creason is the one that prescribed the medication that's being complained of in this case, and his testimony states that he did prescribe the medication. There's no evidence anywhere that appellant ever took the medication, period. And Dr. Creason testified there's no magic pill for Asperger's syndrome. This is a pill the medication I prescribe that will help him with his impulsivity disorder. But again, this has to be include to the medication taken with a comprehensive program. This is an appeal that you just take and is going to help you with any type of issues. This is something that helps you while you're in a comprehensive program learning about social skills and stuff, and helps you to decrease your impulsivity. It's really not a mental competency medication that's going to somehow assist him in having a better understanding of what's happening around him. The trial court in this case obviously was, in my opinion, took the right course by asking whether he had any mental health issues. And when appellant said that he had Asperger's syndrome, the court went on to ask further questions of both appellant and his counsel on, are you on medication? Have you been taking it? Why have you not been taking it? Counsel, why is he not taking his medication? How are your conversations with him going? Do you understand why you're here today, what his proceedings are? Here's what the state is arguing. Have you read that? Do you understand that? Do you need some more time to go speak to your attorney now? Do you have any questions you'd like to ask your attorney right now? And consistently, the appellant's like, yes, I understand what's happening. No, I have no other questions. He understood what was occurring in the courtroom. Their competency was not an issue whatsoever. Once the trial judge concluded asking these questions, and there was no evidence of mental competency before him other than Asperger's syndrome and a medication which was not taken, the judge at that time did the right thing by continuing on to the revocation hearing, which basically inferring that the trial judge decided there was not a bona fide doubt as to appellant's competency. Thus, there was no reason to stay the proceedings or to order a competency hearing requiring an evaluation. Absolutely, Your Justice Meyer. On my brief, pages 5, 6, 7, and one last question on 8, or one statement by the court. And I believe after getting the responses from appellant regarding his understanding and counsel's answers regarding having no problems whatsoever with mental issues or communicating with his client and believing.
So it's not your view that the questions that were later, or the evidence later, presented by Dr. Creason had any effect on the issue of the adequacy of the informal inquiry?
I think it can have an effect because...
Okay, that's what I'm asking you. Is it your position for the state that the questions and testimony of Dr. Creason at a later stage of this proceeding had an effect on the efficiency of question of whether or not the informal inquiry was adequate at the start of this proceeding?
I believe at the time that the testimony of Dr. Creason was presented, that it substantiated the original holding by the trial court, which was pretrial. I think the court made a pretrial initial inquiry into the competency of appellant and then decided to proceed with revocation. And at any time thereafter, prior to sentencing, at any time if there was any additional evidence presented that could have raised an issue as to incompetence, the trial judge at any time prior to sentencing still had the authority and the ability to halt the proceedings and ask further questions or then stay the proceedings and issue a competency hearing. However, I think the evidence that later presented itself during the actual revocation hearing did nothing but substantiate the trial judge's original finding in his initial inquiery.
And your brief recognizes that the trial judge did not make a formal declaration of competency, but you say because the trial judge went on with the revocation hearing after the initial matters were discussed, that infers a finding of competency.
Yes, that would be the state's position. There is no requirement under 46B that if an initial hearing or inquiry is conducted by the trial court, that a specific oral or written finding of competency has to be made by the trial court before proceeding to trial or with a revocation hearing. It basically says that if a bona fide doubt is come to the court's attention after an informal inquiry, they must then halt proceedings, and then you must proceed with the evaluation of a competency hearing or impaneling a separate jury to handle that issue. And because those are mandatory, if you don't do it and continue, that I think that allows the inference that you did not find that it was a bona fide doubt.
So there's the language on 5, 6, 7 and top 8, then the discussion and the testimony that's in the record of Dr. Creason, all are to be considered as part of the evaluation of whether there was an adequate informal inquiry by the doctor.
I guess I almost, the way it's worded, I guess I want to say no, because the informal inquiry, in my opinion, concluded prior to the revocation hearing beginning, and then the later testimony that we're speaking of regarding Dr. Creason and appellant came after the informal inquiry. But had that, during that time, had the judge made his initial informal inquiry and then later began to have further issues, he could have, again, under 46B, halted the proceedings, stayed the proceedings, and say that, you know, recognize that he's now has a bona fide doubt after hearing additional evidence. I don't think that the testimony received by appellant or Dr. Creason consists of an informal inquiry, because at that point we're in a full revocation hearing and it's testimony that's being elicited during that hearing. Whereas the testimony I referred to on pages 5 through 8 is the more of an informal discussion between the trial judge and the parties, and then thereafter we begin into the formal proceedings for the revocation hearing. So I like the testimony of Dr. Creason and appellant. I think it just shows that there was no need later, after an informal inquiry, to then halt the proceedings and argue that a bona fide doubt has now been raised. It further and helped the judge agree that my initial inquiry was right. Now we're hearing from the appellant and Dr. Creason, and this is all adding up. There's no need for me to stop and do another inquiry or halt the proceedings. It substantiated the initial inquiry, which was prior to the hearing having began. Also, the state would like to point to the court to a case from this court, Lawrence v. State, which I believe also cited to 169 Southwest 3D 319. Two of the justices on this panel were on that case and found that the informal inquiry in that case established that the defendant did not suffer from severe mental illness or mental retardation, that he understood he was facing the charges he was facing, he was able to communicate with his attorney, that an ex parte evaluation found him competent, and that his own counsel had no question about his competency. And I would argue to this court that every one of those factors in Lawrence applies here except for the ex parte evaluation. And the state would urge that there is no requirement under law that in conducting an informal inquiry that an evaluation has to be conducted. That's actually an extra bonus that was applied in Lawrence, but is not systematically required under the statute until you've reached a bona fide doubt in your mind regarding competency.
If Dr. Creason had examined him before the hearing as he did, is that anything the trial court could rely on to determine whether a second doctor needed to examine him or whether Dr. Creason needed to re-examine?
I think that's evidence that very well could have come in. Appellant visited with Dr. Creason while he was on probation is when the treatment was occurring. The state did not call Dr. Creason to prove competency because there was not an issue of competency raised until it was raised sua sponte by the court. However, the state would argue that if the appellant and his counsel felt that competency was an issue, then they had every right also to have called in this report. It may have very well been unknown to the trial judge that there is a psychiatrist who's been treating the appellant, until someone brings it to his attention that he's seeing a psychiatrist. The state did not bring that to the court's attention because we do not believe that, there was an issue as to competency. Likewise, appellant's counsel did not bring to the court's attention Dr. Creason during this informal inquiry because counsel also believed there was not an issue as to incompetency. So I would say that any failure to bring that to the court's attention really would be on appellant's shoulder if he was trying to prove incompetency. However, that they were not trying to prove incompetency. This was all sua sponte issue of the trial court, and once the trial court raised it himself and then satisfied himself or herself, they were able to proceed on to the revocation proceedings. I see that I've run out of time. There's no other questions? Thank you very much.
To be perfectly clear, evidence raising a bona fide doubt as to competence is different than evidence that would actually establish incompetency. So I just want to make that clear at the outset. The protections, the statutory protections in Article 46B are there, especially the second subsection, are there because if a trial counsel doesn't raise the issue of competency, it imposes a duty on the trial court to do so. It's there regardless of what somebody's trial counsel does. It imposes a mandatory duty on the trial court, which we know in this case, at least based on the trial court's initial observations of the appellant in open court and his demeanor, the trial court felt it necessary to ask the question of appellant, do you have any mental health problems? So we know that at least something occurred to cause her to do that. After the exchange that we've kind of talked about at length of the trial court asking appellant and his counsel about the medication issue and his competence, the only questions that were asked before the trial court accepted appellant's plea if true and proceeded with the entire adjudication hearing were, did you have a chance to visit with your attorney? Did you ask him any questions? Do you have any questions? Did you go through each of these allegations, and how do you plead? Those were the only questions that the trial court asked appellant or his trial counsel before accepting appellant's plea of true to the allegations contained in the state's motion to adjudicate. So it's our contention that any kind of informal inquiry that was conducted or attempted occurred prior to appellant's entry of his plea of true. Regarding Lawrence, the case Lawrence that we've both cited right now, the appellant in that case said, yes, mental health issues, and the mental health issue in that case was depression. It wasn't necessarily a mental health disorder where he was talking about having medication to treat that, as in this case. And if you, the inquiry in Lawrence consisted of many, many more substantive questions than did any kind of inquiry in this case before proceeding for the rest of the case. And in this, we just have those two questions, basically, of appellant and his trial counsel, and then proceed right into the rest of the hearing. And like we said, that Dr. Creason's testimony was offered in mitigation of any kind of punishment. It wasn't offered during the motion to adjudicate hearing as to whether or not appellant was competent or not. For those reasons, we believe that the trial court violated its statutory duty according to Article 46B, and with that also violated appellant's constitutional rights under the United States Constitution and the federal Constitution, and would ask that this case be vacated, reversed, and remanded back to the trial court for a new hearing. You can certainly try appellant again, assuming that he is found to be competent, before you proceed again. I don't think there's any problem with doing that. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation, counsel, both of you. And your case will be submitted. Thank you very much for your appearance today. And your argument.
All right. Thank you.